This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. NPR has been running a series of reports from Muncie, Indiana, about the problems that family members in that community have faced with the opioid addiction crisis. You heard one this morning on the Morning Edition. More are scheduled ahead. We'll talk with one of the people mentioned in the NPR article, Mike Hicks, who, of course, is the economist from Ball State University, about the problems of economics involving the addiction war. We'll also have, as well, a conversation with, of course, Carl Lissick as he brings us another edition of Green Fleet Radio. And a little later, we'll have Lakeshore Focus host Keith Kirkpatrick and his guest, former Judge William Alexa. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have been featuring on NPR programs like Morning Edition, and again today on All Things Considered, updates on some stories that were run actually last year, last fall, by a reporter, Yuki Noguchi, concerning problems with the opioid crisis in Muncie, Indiana. The latest talking about, with an update actually, on a family with a young woman who was in a coma, now reportedly out of the coma, but still in hospital as a result of her problems with opioid addiction. And there's also mentioned, too, in the NPR article that's on the NPR.org website about the economics of opioid addiction and how much a problem it could be, and it costs certainly for the family members and the individuals involved. Michael Hicks, who is an economist at Ball State University, he's also the director of the Center for Business Economics and Research, has been one of our frequent guests on Regionally Speaking, and he's back with us today to talk more about this. He's mentioned in the NPR article that's online right now if you wish to check it out. Professor Hicks, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's so good to be with you.
Well, I'll let you explain first here. In talking with Yuki Noguchi for the article that is posted on the NPR website about the concerns about the epidemic, and you made an interesting comparison that maybe some people do not think about the fact that the opioid addiction epidemic is like a war.
Well, right. If you compare, for example, the loss of American lives nationwide, I think we count 30,000-40,000 last year related to opioids. That's close to what we lost throughout the entire Vietnam experience of 1962 roughly to 1972. Certainly more than the combination of all the wars since then, and really much more like what a year, close to what a year, or at least 6 months of World War II would have been. It's actually a very, very, devastating loss to a community like Muncie, where the death rates from opioid addiction have gone from, maybe a dozen per 100,000, we're a county of about 125,000, to 50 or 60 per 100,000. That is very much like the World War I, World War II experience in Muncie, greater Muncie area.
I know that in the history books, when you read about the situations and the things that happened overseas during the war, and particularly in the First World War, because nobody really expected that war to be as devastating, at least not at first, as it turned out to be, that there were so many people back home that had felt this impact with the loss of family members as well as economic losses, too, that you can see why the comparison is there.
Right, just in the raw loss of lives. Of course, we're a bigger country now, but, again, I think we account for a full 56,000 lives lost during Vietnam, including training accidents that occurred, stateside. And that's, roughly similar to over almost a decade to a year, year and a half of the opioid crisis. And it's not evenly spread across the country. It's certainly not it's in every community, but it's not maybe as devastating everywhere in terms of the proportion of deaths and overdose, and the fiscal effect as well seems to be more concentrated than other drug episodes.
You talk about in the article, in your conversation with the NPR reporters about the economic loss, in what ways can such losses be measured?
Right. It's a painful calculus, but What most people think of, they say, well, you know, we think about the hospitalization costs or the costs of burying someone and maybe the costs of naloxone. And those are certainly non-trivial expenses, right? But the real cost is the loss of a life of productivity. I mean, this is striking young people, predominantly 20s and 30s, the loss of a lifetime productivity, the value of the services they provide as a member of a market economy, and then just also the effect that that has on families, their inability to care for children. Certainly Indiana is experiencing just a huge spike in opioid-related foster child demand. So, you know, just a huge increase in the number of children that are left without parents or without functioning parents. And those costs per person run in the millions of dollars, whereas, you know, the cost of naloxone or the cost of treating somebody in a hospital are measured in the tens of thousands. So it's a much bigger effect, I think, than most people suppose before we start thinking about the, you know, less monetary consequences of heartache and the, you know, loss of a big portion of a generation in some communities.
What kind of work have you and your colleagues there at the Center for Business Economics and Research at Ball State been able to do in comparing the numbers that we talk about, and certainly the healthcare issues and the loss of lives and the, everything that's come about as a result of the opioid addiction crisis and the economy? What kind of the impact that it has on the economy?
Well, we're, I think, contributing to research that a lot of economists are now very interested in, and that's, you know, the effect of maybe fractured communities on healthcare outcomes. And these range from Case and Angus Deaton at Princeton. He received a Nobel Prize for work that he did in chronicling, among other things, chronicling poverty and healthcare-related issues. And they noted a couple of years ago the increase in mortality rates or the reduction in the lifespan of middle-aged white Americans for the first time in a century that is clearly related to opioid use and drug addiction and this spike of deaths. And what we have done is study the effect of automation exposure, job risk due to the sort of organic changes that are occurring in factories and workplaces and the consequential health, self-reported health conditions of households. And we found a fairly strong correlation. The bigger the sort of regional risk of jobs going away, the worse healthcare outcomes tended to be, even when you accounted for, 20 or 30 other things that would otherwise account for. So kind of a shocking result related to the labor market, discouragement that I think a lot of Americans have been feeling for a decade or so.
Have you had a chance with you and your colleagues to get together and talk about these issues and been able to bring it closer, literally closer to home? In this case, we're talking about Muncie and Delaware County in particular, since the problem is everywhere in Indiana and around the country, of course, where it may be some instances where some people are aware of some of the impacts because of the opioid epidemic on the community in particular.
Well, this is something. Observing the real world is what informs our decision of what we research. And we typically run statistical models, but we're trying to think about what are the issues that are sort of plaguing our community or before our community. And working at Ball State University, there's no evidence of an opioid crisis or drug use, other than a little bit extra beer on a Saturday night like most campuses.
Right.
So we're fairly immune in this little bubble. But if you run down to the hospital, I've got two teenage boys, and so we've been to the emergency room a couple times in the last year for teenage boy-related orthopedic injuries. And in each instance, there was a heroin addict in the emergency room and in the midst of an overdose, either unconscious or suffering severely from overdose exposure. And that, to have a 13-year-old who's there for a soccer injury or a 16-year-old who's there with breaking his ankle in tennis practice. Those are things that most Americans are going to continue to experience as the crisis becomes more gripping and more, the death rate rises. So I think when we asked in the emergency room, it was an everyday experience for them to have someone under the influence of opioids. And I think that's probably true in every hospital in every town of 50,000 people or more in the United States.
Are you noting as well, taking a look at sort of the historical view of this, about what we are seeing in the opioid addiction crisis that is gripping the country as well as the state of Indiana, in some notice to how it turned out that maybe this is a much, much worse situation than might have been, say, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, back in the 50s, when it seemed to be that the crisis was dealing with heroin?
Right. So we talked offline before. I grew up in Washington, D.C., so you know, I'm old enough to remember the heroin, what we thought was a heroin crisis in the early 70s in the D.C. area, and angel dust or PCP when I was a teen. And then, you know, it moved to, I was in West Virginia as a researcher in the turn of the century when OxyContin and oxycodone was the new drug and meth were the new drugs. All of those, you know, there's sort of two dynamics. As one drug goes away, some of the same users or becomes less prevalent because of law enforcement or whatever. Some users move to the next drug, but the scale of the opioid addiction is much larger than any of the experiences we have seen before. And for a drug of this kind, right? Obviously, marijuana use and alcohol use are much more prevalent, but the sort of scale of a human toll, the effect on health, the effect on mortality are much different in the current crisis than we have seen before, and come with that, because of that, much more a bigger fiscal strain and much more fundamental and long-term economic consequences.
What kind of impact are you seeing, if there's any yet to see, because it's kind of early, I suppose, in this unfortunate situation, with the government funding and even the family resources trying to come up with the money to deal with the problems of the addiction crisis? Are we going to have, at least what you see, the help that Congress is supposed to be able to offer through the administration to be able to respond to the opioid epidemic?
Well, I mean, sort of two answers to that. At the end of the day, it's really fundamentally a local problem. Local, you know, the people who deal with this are going to be the local law enforcement, the city, the small town police department, the first responders, the healthcare providers, and you can provide some resources to support that, you know, to the federal level. But and the federal government has done that with naloxone, and states are doing that to sort of make it possible for very cash-strapped communities to have available some of those resources. You know, but ultimately, if this is something that's going to kill, you know, 50 out of every 100,000 Americans every year for a decade, and goodness knows how many more are close to death or not functioning members of society as a consequence of it, then those dollars are going to be nothing's going to prove. There's almost nothing we can spend to you know, sort of fully mitigate or stop that. It's really going to fall on families, and I think Yukiniguchi did a really good job of demonstrating the damage this it does to families and how it left, you know, elderly people bankrupt caring for children and grandchildren.
I know that last year when she started in on the series, the first of the series began, I think, back in November of last year, and then she's picked up an update now with the latest reports that have been on NPR and we carried on Lakeshore Public Radio. But I know even back then was a concern about whether the organizations in the community, and particularly there in Muncie, that are trying to help addicts and people who are trying to recover from the addiction, to be sure how they're dealing with it. And I know that the updates are just as sad, I guess. Things haven't changed all that much, even with the organizations, the community organizations, that is, in Muncie trying to help people out.
Well, right, and I think we have to give some credit to, you know, the local faith community, the healthcare providers who are jumping in trying to fix this, but, you know, it takes a long time to pull the resources together, even in a community that has a strong, you know, nonprofit community that's focused on this. The dynamic is very complex, right? And that's why we haven't solved the problem. We usually solve easy problems first, and harder ones are much more. But it could well be part of a very complex healthcare-related problem that's, you know, mental health issues that we don't do very well with. We struggle on everything from very benign healthcare issues to very complex ones. And if we're in communities where there are a lot of people who are not capable of working, and they fall back into opioid use. I mean, you can see very deep geographic inequities that stress the fiscal environment in these places, right? So it's not like the problem is happening in the really, you know, affluent communities. There are certainly some problems there, but the ones that have the most resources may well be the ones that are least affected by the challenges here.
Now, have you and the other folks there at the Center for Business Economics and Research been able to maybe set aside some time or some research efforts to be able to continue to look at this, or are you going to have to just kind of wait until the opportunities come up to be able to continue to study the economic impact of the opioid epidemic on everyday life, pretty much, and not only in Muncie and in Indiana, for that matter?
Well, we like to preserve the division of labor, so as an economist, I'm not going to get into what I think are, you know, anthropological questions. How do people find meaning in life, and how does drug or addiction affect that? We're a team of economists and sociologists, so we are acutely interested in things that are outside what most people would think of the typical domain of economics. You know, we're not just about the stock market. We care about, you know, is productivity affected? Do we have intergenerational damage to households because, you know, younger children are negatively affected as a consequence of this? So we're trying to study those things, but it takes time. It takes time to read what other scholars have done. It takes time to get new data. And it's not just an opioid issue. It's an issue of other despairs, you know, deaths of despair or drug-related issues. So it's not just opioids. It could be alcohol. It could be, diabetes as a result of people eating poorly because they don't have, good access to health care. And so right. I think it's a very complex question. We're one of many groups of people trying to answer some questions around it.
Well, it sounds like then that there's going to be an awful lot of work that's going to, an investment, I suppose, in not only research time and effort, but in money as well to try to resolve the issue of the opioid epidemic across, in this case, in Muncie, as well as the rest of Indiana and the rest of the country. So it's going to be a topic that obviously you and your colleagues there at Ball State University are going to be following for quite some time, I would imagine.
I think so. We're not going to arrest our way out of this, and we're not going to hope our way out of it. So I think the public sector response and the private sector response is going to have to be a bit more vigorous and thoughtful in the years to come than it has been.
Now, since you had a chance to talk with Yuki Noguchi here during the original series that got started last fall, and it's continuing now through NPR, do you think that you're liable to be visited again by another team of staff from NPR News to get updates of what you've been working on?
Well, it could be. The NPR staff has been interested in our work in automation and job, you know, related disturbance over the past several years. You know, we're going to continue that. And I think that fits into the challenges facing, you know, particularly the Midwest, where we have very large share of manufacturing employment. We have a lot of small towns. We have some really fast-growing, great places. And that mix of challenges and opportunities are where it's good for research to try to help, I think, inform public policy. That's kind of what our mission is and what we at a public research university are trying to contribute.
Well, Michael Hicks, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about this issue, and we'll look forward to what NPR News is putting out here on the updates about the problems that they've been studying with the opioid epidemic in this very small look at it in Muncie, Indiana, and we'll see how it happens to compare to the rest of the country as well, too. Thank you for taking some time to be with us today.
Appreciate the chance to talk.
Michael Hicks is an economist. He is also the director of the Center for Business Economics and Research at Ball State University. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here is your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Ms. Leah Thill. She's the environmental planner for the Michiana Area Council of Governments, or MACOG. Leah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, Leah, could you tell our listeners a little bit of what MACOG is and what you do?
Yes. So MACOG is a voluntary organization of local government, and we study and attempt to resolve areas of interlocal issues. So those are things that either have regional impacts or might benefit from wider coordination beyond traditional municipal boundaries to resolve issues like keeping our air clean.
Sure. And so I know you are working with a great project. It's called the Partners for Clean Air Program. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. So the Partners for Clean Air program is, again, a voluntary organization of citizens, businesses, and organizations who are making efforts to keep our air clean here in our region. And we also educate the public about simple actions everyone can take to protect our health and keep our air clean, especially on days when the air quality is unhealthy for our sensitive population.
And I know you've got a big event that's coming up. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes, we annually recognize those who have gone above and beyond to keep our air clean at our annual Partners for Clean Air luncheon on April 25th. And then we also highlight that the Air Quality Action Day advisory season is starting May through September, and that's when we might see some more issues, especially with ozone, that could affect people. So we're trying to raise awareness about that, and people can go to the website cleanairmichiana.com to find more about what you can do to make a difference, especially on those days.
Sure, and as you recognize your Partners for Clean Air on April 25th, how would people get involved with that, Leah?
So they can go to our website, MACOG.com, email us, ask a question, and we'd be happy to share more information.
Wonderful. And I know MACOG is very interested in electric vehicles and electric vehicle infrastructure. So why has MACOG taken an interest in those issues?
Well, vehicles certainly contribute a significant amount of the pollution that we see in our local air. And so by reducing the number of tailpipes in our communities or the emissions coming from those tailpipes, we can have cleaner air for everyone to breathe. And with electric vehicles, the plug-in electric hybrids, as our electricity mix continues to get cleaner, the benefits increase from there.
You're listening to Green Fleet Radio. Our guest is Ms. Leah Thill, the environmental planner for MACOG. And Leah, as we talk about some of the availability of electric vehicle charging stations, is that actually improving in the MACOG region?
It is starting to improve. We just saw in March of this year the very first charging station installed in a downtown area in our region that's in the city of South Bend here. So we're excited to see that availability increase. And although people may be charging 90% of the time at home, they need to know that they can travel throughout the region and have places to charge when they need them.
That's very exciting. And again, I think, you know, with all the great things that are going on in the Michiana area, it's great to see additional charging stations being planned and, you know, coordinated throughout the area. So we're really excited about being involved with you on that. So I know you've got some events coming up, Leah. Where can people learn more about electric vehicles, including a few with South Shore Clean Cities?
We are excited to offer an electric vehicle ride and drive education event in partnership with South Shore Clean Cities and downtown South Bend. So that will be May 1st, Friday. That's May the 4th. And it'll be a chance to get behind the wheel of a plug-in vehicle, talk to local EV drivers about their experience, and we hope to continue to provide educational events like this in other MACOG communities moving forward.
Yeah, and again, very exciting. How can people learn more about MACOG and upcoming MACOG events?
They can go to our website, that's MACOG.com, or give us a call at 574-287-1829, and we'd be happy to discuss these issues and provide educational resources.
You know, Leah, as we come to the end of our program, is there any closing thoughts that you would have for our listeners?
Yes. One thing that I'd like to point out is that the number of plug-in electric vehicles in the South Bend Elkhart region has nearly tripled just in the last 3 years, according to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles here, and that's been despite any publicly available stations in downtown or business district areas. So we are absolutely seeing the strong interest, and we're doing what we can to unlock the greater adoption of cleaner vehicles and address some of the range anxiety and public awareness gaps.
Well, I know, again, Leah, it's all about partnerships. And again, you know, not just working with Clean Cities, but working with all the Michiana area communities. And everybody's really been receptive on change. And I think, you know, MACOG has done a wonderful job in regards to introducing different types of concepts to the different, you know, leaders throughout the Michiana area. Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, some of the other great programs that you're doing. I know that you've been very much involved with solar in and around the Michiana area.
So we were involved in the Soul Smart program, which assisted local governments in becoming more solar ready and solar friendly, training their firefighters or inspectors to be aware of new and changing technologies and be prepared for that. We were also involved in the grassroots effort of local communities here through the Solarize initiative, which helped 97 new solar projects in the region come online. So we were very excited to see the kind of grassroots efforts that have come out of some of the interest in solar in the region here.
No, that's exciting. 97, that's a huge number. And, you know, we're very excited to see what 2018 brings to the MACOG area. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thanks you again to Leah Thill. She's the environmental planner for the MACOG area. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks again for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Greenfleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, and you can hear Greenfleet Radio here on Wednesdays on Regionally Speaking, and podcasts of Greenfleet Radio are also available on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Not long ago on Lakeshore PBS, Lakeshore Focus host Keith Kirkpatrick had a chance to talk with a gentleman from Porter County who's not only been a very accomplished person in the public government service world, but also in private life as well, too. He had a chance to talk with Porter County Circuit Court Judge William Alexa. And here's the conversation.
From time to time, I schedule interviews with area key leaders who have had intriguing journeys through their life. It's a time to listen to their observations, insights, and wisdom. Today's guest falls into that category. He has served in many capacities in his life, most recently as a Superior Court judge in Porter County and as a former Indiana State Senator. Let's start our conversation with Bill Alexa. So, after all those important titles, Bill, what am I supposed to call you now?
Bill is just fine.
And you've always kind of been Bill to a lot of people, haven't you?
I have. I don't go with the titles very often. I'm just an ordinary person who's doing something a little different.
So you were on the bench how long?
I was on the bench for 15 years.
Wow, and the state senator?
15 years.
And your previous life for 15 years?
For 15 years, actually a little longer than that. But I was also a deputy and chief deputy prosecuting attorney in the 70s. That's where it started.
So you've kind of been in multiple roles. You've been in the legislative, you've been in the judicial, and you've been a public servant.
And the executive, that's just what the prosecutor is.
Well, there you go. Mm-hmm. So you've seen all sides of this.
I have.
Wow. So as a judge, what was the most difficult part of being a judge for you?
I think the most difficult part for me was to pay very close attention to a hearing, or particularly to a jury trial, and to make sure that I received all of the information that was put forth. That was difficult. And then after that, writing an opinion or an order on it. It was time consuming, and I had staff who were fantastic, a court reporter who could reproduce anything that happened. But that was the most difficult, I think, actually.
So you're telling me, when we see these pictures of judges who look like they're so thoughtful and listening so closely to the jury, you have a tendency, or they have a tendency, to think, I wonder what we're having for dinner tonight, or, you know, I wonder if my car will start in the morning.
No, I've never gone quite like that. But sometimes it can become a little bit, I don't want to say boring, but boring. It depends on how the attorneys handle the case, how the witnesses respond. And of course, you're watching the witnesses. One of the ways that you can judge what a person is saying, whether it's a truth or a false, is by watching their mannerisms and watching what they do and listen to the way they say things out of the witness stand.
I never thought about that before. I often share with people, you know, what it's like to be the host of this show. And I said, you know, when you're doing the interview, it's all your energy and focus has to be on the guest and what you're talking about. I never thought about that before, but a judge has that same challenge. Every bit of your energy has to be focused on that trial or what's going on in your courtroom.
But that's part of the difficulty that I mentioned earlier. Not only that, you have two attorneys on opposite sides out there who are doing different things, and you're checking to make sure that no one's coaching a witness while they're up there or making funny signs at them, because that happens sometimes, not often, but that's the kind of thing that you're looking for.
Yeah, there is a lot of similarity, because I tell people, you know, I got to watch all the cues and see all the stuff going on in the background, plus focus here. But you know, I only have to do this for a half hour. You often would have to do that for 6-7 hours in a day.
And possibly for the whole week, depending on how long a trial would go.
So I have a higher admiration for people on the bench at this point. So that's pretty amazing. In the time that you were on the bench, is there one case, and maybe you can't talk about it in any specifics, I don't want you to, but just really was a tough one to do, or one that just really was just kind of pulled at your who you are? And
that's a good question, actually. The cases that drew that kind of a response to me, to the question, would be criminal cases. You're in a case, you're shepherding a trial where someone has to be proved guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and you always have something in your mind: what's happening here? Is it a fair trial? Is it this? And you know, that's what we try to do. The cases, every one of them, but the really difficult ones were child molestation cases. And of course, we've had a plethora of those in the past, two or three years. And those were the most difficult, actually.
And I don't even have to ask you why, because I think that's pretty apparent why those would be
sure.
Very disturbing, because I think we hear those kind of things going on today, and it's still very, very disturbing.
But perhaps just with a little different perspective. A prosecutor determines which cases he will or will not file. And they're supposed to look at the evidence and determine that, yes, they have enough evidence, and file the case. And then, if they don't have enough evidence, they file it anyway sometimes. And it's a case that maybe shouldn't have been filed. You're putting a family or a defendant through a tremendous strain for the time of the charge all the way to the end of the trial. And I've had several of those where a jury came back not guilty after 5 minutes or 10 minutes of deliberations. And those are very disconcerting.
Was there a time, I'm going to keep focused on the bench here a little bit.
Sure.
But was there a time that you felt like that your role, kind of like you had the wisdom of Solomon, and that you just, what you said or did just really felt profound, or what you did really helped reach a conclusion to a case?
My wife would tell you that she thinks that I think that way all the time, but it's not true.
Wives are kind of like that, right? I think sometimes.
Well, they are.
Spouses.
Well, yeah, you get home and she says, "Look, mister, you're not on that bench anymore." Okay.
Well, before we get back to that question, I was going to ask you about your wife anyway, because, you know, you've got this name Alexa, which now has become so popular. Do you hear Joyce every once in a while say, "Alexa," and then she asks you a question and she expects an answer?
I'm not geared to answer that question.
So back to the wisdom of Solomon. Did you ever feel that you had that moment where it's just like, wow, what came out of my mouth was pretty profound?
No.
Never?
Never.
Did you feel like you had a case where you really made a difference in what you were doing and just how you helped shape it?
Yes. I think you can almost just about say that on every case that comes up. It depends on what your rulings are out there to a degree, to an objection or to something like that. And that can have a bearing on how the outcome of the case will be. But I don't see anything profound with that. But it does influence what happens in the courtroom and in the case.
If there were a couple of things that you would like to give as a message to the general public about behavior in court, or these things are real important to do when you're in court, or these are the things please do not ever do in court, what would a couple of those be?
Don't ever stand up and holler. Don't ever stand up and give the judge or anyone in the courtroom one of the nasty finger flips or anything like that, because we've had that happen. And to just show respect, maybe not for the judge, for the office that judge represents. And, you know, the whole system is geared to that, the judicial system. You know, there's a reason that the bench sits higher than the rest of the courtroom. There's a reason that there are flags on either side of the judge's bench. There's a reason that the court's announced when it begins its daily session. Everybody rise and what have you. It's all about the image that that court is supposed to engender in the people who come before it. And it's kind of a good feeling to know that you're a part of that system.
Do you think that the general public has lost that respect and for the court over the years?
I think it's less than it was when I started 15 years ago, actually. I'm not sure what the reason is for it. I think that the news media and what's happening all across this country, not just here in Porter and Lake, Northwest Indiana. And I think that that's true. And some of the things that have happened that involve judges are not exactly what should happen. But those are few and far between, thankfully.
So you've kind of made a nice transition to just what's your kind of take on the whole temperament of the country at the moment around all kinds of issues. I guess it's hard to say it's just politics. It just seems like it's a lot of issues going on in the country.
I think
at the moment.
That's very true. And I think it's an angry mood, and I think that's the base that is moving people at this point. No tolerance for someone else's opinion. We have more than 50%, so we're right and you go to the devil. And that's just not the way our system is supposed to be run. I mean, you talked about the Constitution earlier, not in a promo, but the Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag starts out, Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag of the United States of America, in this word, and to the Republic for which it stands. People forget that. They say we're a democratic democracy. Well, we are, but we're a republic. And the republic means that the people with more votes pay attention to the people who didn't have enough votes to do it, and they consider their opinions in doing it. And I think we're losing that,
that
frankly.
You're right, that seems to be lost. So why do you think people are so angry?
I'm not sure about that. I think that some of the hyperbole that is on TV, I think that some of the way people act, and it's highlighted on TV, and I think that's all part of it. I'm not certain why people are acting that way. They're irritated with the way things are going. And that can be with the Congress, with a General Assembly, a county council. It could be with any part of it.
So when you were a state senator, part of the General Assembly in Indiana, you had a lot of experience down there. If you kind of look at what's going on over the past few years, I mean, how do you kind of assess the effectiveness of or the role that group takes?
That's when I started there, would have been in 1988, and I ran for office at that point because I saw all of the children in the community, not all, but the children not coming back. And so the theme was, why aren't they coming back? Let's do something to bring them back. And we moved on to 92, the next election, and Joyce, my wife, and I said, why are we doing this? What's the reason for it? Very simple. We wanted to make a difference, and that was our theme from 1992 on. And we did that. When I started there in 88, there were 26 Republicans in the Senate and 24 Democrats, and it was one of the best experience that I've ever had, because you had to work together. You plain had to if you wanted to get anything passed. And it worked very well. By the time I was ready to leave in 02, that had changed. And the change meant that there were 20 Democrats and 30 Republicans. And then you could see the trend in what was happening. And there was a time coming, I thought, that we wouldn't have to even have Democrats come. They could have the session by themselves. And, of course, they could do that now. And that disturbed me quite a little bit. And
I've heard Senator Rogers talk about that same thing when I had her on, too, saying things used to work better. People
Absolutely.
Used to get along better. We used to listen, as you said, to the to the other side. So can we get back to that, you think?
I think we can, but it's not going to be done easily. I think the stem cause of that is redistricting and redrawing maps every 10 years. The party that's in charge, and it doesn't matter, Democrats or Republicans, draw the maps to suit their needs as a caucus and also for the individuals in there. I remember the first redistricting that I was in was in 1990. And we had a computer there. And the computer had a mouse with it, a screen, and there was the map of the state of Indiana. And you could pick out your district, and mine was the 5th district, click on it, and then you could take that mouse and trace the line. And as you changed it, it told you how many Democrats, Republicans, and Independents were in that district. Now, that's the way that redistricting was done. It still is. The way that you can change what we started out with is to change the way that the districts are set up and take it away from the legislative branch and put it into a commission with the appropriate membership and let them do the redistricting in a fair and impartial way so that we can get back to Pledge of Allegiance and talking about a republic.
Yeah, I had never heard that explanation of how that redistricting, so all of us who are on computers and who've moved the mouse around and watched the data change, now I get that, so you're saying it's also just so simple to do. Let me ask you this, kind of similar to being on the bench in the legislature, what piece of legislation or something you participated in you look back and say, I'm just really proud of, I'm really happy I was part of this law or something we did in the legislature?
There were so many. There really were so many. Some generated from within the district, one of which was what they're calling the anti-SLAPP legislation. That was out for a purpose, and they tried to distort it a little bit since. But
so what's that, the anti-SLAPP? What is that?
It'd be used, let's just pick an example here, in St. Joe County, because that's really part of what it was. The county was building a new jail out on a woman's farm, and they had a battle over hearings and what have you, and they just kept taking her to court. They had all the resources in the world, like a huge corporation would come in and kind of nickel and dime you to death. And they'd win that way. And we stopped that with that legislation. Hmm. Put them on a more equal footing.
Was there one issue that you felt like you never got closure on when you were there?
Oh, there were quite a few.
Is there one that still just bugs you today?
No, not today. I've gotten over that some time back. There's nothing I can really do about that. Now, I did have something happen in the courtroom. It was, at least to me, it was interesting. I had a case going. There were two attorneys. And the one attorney's talking about a law the General Assembly had passed. And he says, the intent of the legislator when they did this particular bill was this. And the other one says, no, it was this. I says, stop. I says, if you look at that, I'm the author of the bill, and I'll tell you what I meant. That happened twice in 15 years, that's it.
That must have been a little unusual, but
that was very unusual.
It felt a little gratifying probably, right?
Very, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So what do you think that Indiana still needs to do today? I mean, what is that issue that the legislature still continues to slide over, gloss over, not deal with, that we really should be doing something about?
My top of my list is redistricting, actually.
Okay. But since we talked about that, what's kind of that second item, maybe? I know there's probably a list.
Well, there is. It's a long list. I don't even want to start because we could just go down to everything that never comes out of committee.
Is there just one, though, that sticks out? What's the first one that comes to your mind?
I really can't pick one out. They're all on the same footing.
Well, what does that mean when we have so many then? I mean, you're like, wow, the list is so big.
it's hard to pick one out. What does that say about our legislature?
It says that they're going to get through the legislation that each chamber wants. And that's done through the committee system. If a bill is assigned to committee, it's got a chance to come out the rest of the way. If it's never assigned to a committee, that thing is just gone by the wayside.
Well,
and if it comes out of the committee and it's a pass vote for it, it comes out on the floor, it's likely to pass the entire body. So you have to talk to the committee chairman to do that.
So we're down to just a couple minutes here. If you reflect back upon your entire career, just a piece of something you've learned that you just felt like, this is a piece of wisdom. I mean, you know, through life, I've kind of learned this.
Well, don't take yourself too seriously. Just go out there and do your job, whatever it is, and have the support of your family, particularly your wife. She ran all of my campaigns, by the way. There were just so many of those, too. It really was. But they were personal things that she and I just kind of kept. We weren't out for publicity, or you didn't see a whole lot of me doing a lot of things, but we were.
Well, I know your wife, and I know she's a formidable force, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
So I saved my best question to last, down here at the last couple seconds. So I think everybody really wants to know, what do judges really wear under those gowns?
That's a good question. And this is the part I really enjoy. After a jury trial, particularly a criminal trial, I go in and talk to the jurors afterward. And they're pretty down in the dumps. I mean, they've made a decision that, oh, my gosh, you know, somebody's going to jail, somebody, whatever it might be. And they're feeling bad. So I ask them, you know, what did you think about this? And finally, I says, I have the answer to the question that you all want. And I grab the zipper and rip that thing down and throw it open. And they go wild. And they go home happier people than they would have walked out of there without that. So I wear what I'm wearing now, basically.
So,
and if I wore it differently, I wouldn't tell you.
You've always kept your sense of humor, and I appreciate that about you. Thanks for being on the show and sharing your thoughts. It means a lot.
Thank you for having me.
You bet.
Lakeshore Focus airs on Friday evenings at 7:30, and it's rebroadcast on Sunday mornings at 9:30 on Lakeshore PBS.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. On October 25, 1952, a scientist named Melba Phillips walked into a New York City courtroom, which she was summoned to because of her involvement in a teachers' union. This period in American history was full of fear, especially in the scientific community. Tensions with Russia and widespread fear of communism was rising as the Cold War was brewing, creating a general sense of paranoia known as the Red Scare. Meanwhile, scientists like Melba were still reeling from having been asked to participate in weapons creation during World War II and were hoping to avoid making weapons in the future. Melba was a principled woman. She believed that science should be a force for good, not evil, and supported her colleague and mentor Robert J. Oppenheimer, one of the fathers of the atomic bomb, that notably spoke out against its use and regretted its creation. So, without any fanfare, Melba answered all of the reasonable questions that the McCarran Committee of New York, which was the state version of the U.S. Congress's McCarthy-era anti-communist agenda. But when asked point blank whether she or any of her colleagues were communists, she refused to answer. Because she invoked her Fifth Amendment rights in a federal hearing, an act that was temporarily illegal during this paranoid time, Melba was fired from her two jobs, as a researcher at Columbia University and professor at Brooklyn College in New York City. How did this small town Hoosier end up as a nuclear physicist in a courtroom in New York City, defending freedom of speech during a time when most people were scared to do so? How was Melba so courageous when supposedly liberal institutions like Brooklyn College were blinded by fear and cowed to authority during this time? Let's go back to 1907, when this brave and brilliant woman was born and raised in Hazleton, Indiana, a small farming community in Pike County. Melba came from a long line of Hoosier farmers and schoolteachers, and as a child, she thought she would become a schoolteacher as well. Though not many people from Hazleton have become world-class scientists, Melba herself once noted that many of her famous colleagues in science were also from small farming towns just like Hazleton. Perhaps we don't give rural America enough credit in creating some of the greatest minds of our nation. Growing up, Melba thought she would continue her family's tradition in education by becoming a teacher. And in a lot of ways, she did. However, she also became one of our nation's greatest physicists in a time when not many women had opportunities to pursue science. In fact, Melba was one of Robert J. Oppenheimer, one of the fathers of the atomic bomb's first PhD students. In 1935, together they created a theory called the Oppenheimer-Phillips process, which is one of the earliest explorations of nuclear physics. Together, they discovered that during this process, they could create a nuclear reaction with less energy than previously believed was possible. Without this early discovery in nuclear physics, it's possible that Oppenheimer would never have been able to create the atomic bomb, or any of the more positive results of nuclear physics, which range from the discovery of clean energy to carbon dating, the technology that allows us to date items found during archaeological digs. Melba was a physics professor and researcher for most of her life and did not appreciate attention focused on her for anything other than her scientific contributions. In interviews conducted in the 70s, Melba often downplayed the difficulties of being a woman in science. In the mid-1900s, however, it is clear that she faced considerable sexism and discrimination. She claimed that though everyone treated her very well, she experienced many instances of economic discrimination. She was often passed over for jobs explicitly because she was a woman. Superiors would tell her that they would love to give her a job, but that men needed higher-paying jobs to support their families. These prejudiced hiring practices perhaps prevented Melba from reaching her full potential as a scientific innovator. However, it can also be said that it is precisely because of these setbacks that she was forced to turn her attention to the state of science education in this country. Throughout her lifetime, Melba was able to innovate new and interesting ways to teach science. She especially focused her attention on creating more engaging models of teaching, that students working hands-on with organisms and chemicals in labs were more likely to form a connection with science and ultimately create lifelong lovers of science. By improving the ways that teachers taught science, especially to overlooked students, she is partially responsible for inspiring future generations of scientists. Melba's career was a perfect harmony of the sciences and the humanities. She was innovative as a nuclear physicist and as an educator. From Melba, we see a Hoosier innovator that channeled her small-town Hoosier values of education and courage throughout her career. After retiring, Melba moved back to southern Indiana to live out the remainder of her life. She passed away in 2004. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burton.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. Hope you'll join us tomorrow on the program. Leslie Plesak from Purdue University Northwest will be with us to bring us an update on the upcoming Sinai Forum Speaker Series this year.